We are talking today with Steve Cole. He is the associate editor at the Washington Post. He is also author of the book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. Steve, thanks for talking with us today.
Hey, glad to be with you.
Let me begin and ask you, what was the motivation in writing your book, Ghost Wars?
Well, I'd been posted out to South Asia as a foreign correspondent between 1989 and 1992, and I worked, lived in India, but I traveled a lot to Afghanistan during those years, both to the government-controlled cities and then across the border from Pakistan, traveling with the Mujahideen. And I just got very involved in not only Afghanistan and its problems, its humanitarian crises and its war, but also with the rising problem of Sunni radical Islamist movements who were a factor in the war when I was covering it, and trying to sort out where those movements got their strength and how they received support from foreign governments. And even after the 3 years that I spent located in the region, I went and I covered transnational subjects, terrorism and that. So I was covering Bin Laden in the mid-90s. After September 11th, I just, you know, I felt like there was a story about where those attacks had came from as it was rooted in sort of American foreign policy, American intelligence policy, and the story of Afghanistan that I ought to try to go back and pull together, that, you know, that was now urgent in a way that it hadn't been before.
Yeah, it seemed like there's a real need for this missing piece of history, and the media didn't really, in my opinion, do a very good job on filling us in after September 11th.
Yeah, you know, there's also a lot of this history was hidden in a way that even other complicated history isn't, in the sense that, first of all, you know, a lot of the story in Afghanistan between 1979 and 2001 was shaped by intelligence agencies operating in secret. American foreign policy was conducted to an unusually large extent in Afghanistan by the CIA, first as part of the anti-Soviet covert action program of the 1980s, and then later in the 1990s when they went back to try to get Bin Laden on a counterterrorism mandate. But it wasn't just the CIA. Pakistan's involvement in Afghanistan, which was substantial, was carried out through their intelligence service called the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, which is essentially a division of the Pakistan Army. And also Saudi Arabia's efforts to manage Afghanistan and control its politics were carried out by their intelligence service. So you had all of this important history essentially located in secret services. And so as a journalist, this was daunting. There weren't a lot of records to rely on, though there were some. The further back you went, the more you could find. But mostly what I did was to try to dig it out through interviewing by tracking down the individuals who were involved.
And were they fairly forthcoming?
Well, eventually I was able to interview substantial numbers of senior intelligence officers in four countries, United States, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Afghanistan itself. And I think I was able to stitch together a pretty complete picture of the different phases of their conflicts and operations, yeah.
Okay, so tell us about how the U.S. initially got involved in Afghanistan.
So the Soviets invaded in December 1979, and it was a huge crisis on the world stage, and the resistance to the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan was very broadly based and very popular in Afghanistan. It involved just about every segment of Afghan society. I mean, this communist revolution that the Soviet Union tried to impose on Afghanistan was just an utter failure from the beginning. It didn't have anything to do with Afghan national traditions or politics. It was just imposed from outside. And so the whole society rose up in arms against it. And that was already underway when the Americans came along. And the United States decided, in order to punish the Soviet Union for invading Afghanistan or to raise the costs of that invasion, that they would secretly start to provide guns and money to the Afghan rebels. And that program began almost immediately after the Soviet invasion. And it grew and grew in size and scale during the 1980s until by 1987, 1988, the annual allocations that were being made by Congress in secret as part of the black budget were in the neighborhood of $500-700 million a year. And then that allocation was matched dollar for dollar by the Saudi intelligence service. It would essentially just write a matching funds check. So you had these guerrilla groups, many of them radical and Islamist in their outlook, receiving by the late 80s, you know, upwards of $1 billion in guns and money straight up, plus additional contributions from charities and proselytizers in the Persian Gulf. So that was a that was the scale of the involvement. Now, one thing that I think is really important about the way it happened in the 80s, given our interest today in the sort of post 9/11 world, is that when the United States decided to help the Afghan resistance, the CIA also made a decision to not get involved in all of the details of local politics. Essentially, they subcontracted the politics of this jihad to the Pakistan Army. This was a generation of CIA officers recently scarred by their experiences in Vietnam who essentially said, no more hearts and minds for us. We're terrible at picking winners and losers in the developing world. Here in Afghanistan, we don't have any interest in doing so anyway. We're here for one purpose, which is to punish the Soviet Union. If the Pakistanis want to promote radical Sunni Islamists or invite in Arab volunteers or create room for Osama bin Laden because they have their own reasons for doing so, which were to control Afghanistan through the promotion of political Islam, that's fine. That's their business. It may be distasteful, but it's really not of interest to us. And so that was the pattern that led to the character of the resistance, not just the guns and money, but also the kind of standing back and letting the Pakistanis define the politics.
Was there any resistance within the CIA towards that policy of just letting things go?
There was some, and within the State Department as well. And the later it got, the sharper the debate became, and the easier it was for some people involved to see that this looked like it might go badly wrong. And, you know, in the early days, this decision to just focus on the Soviets and not worry about the details was not really challenged. But by 1986, 87, 88, it became clear that the strength of these Islamist factions and the resistance was a potential problem. Nobody could envision an attack all the way across the Atlantic Ocean in those days, but they could see that it could destabilize the region, that it could become a sanctuary for terrorism, a sanctuary for drug trafficking, a sanctuary for international ambitions of the bin Laden sort of volunteer movement, Al-Qaeda as it became known in 1988. And so there were dissents expressed at the time saying, you know, we really ought to change our course. And the other turning point was that the Soviets made it clear that they really were going to leave in about 1987, 1988, signed the Geneva Accords, and by early 1989, they were physically gone. So now you really didn't have a basis to pursue the old theory because you had achieved your objective. And so then a second phase of the debate opened up, which is, does the United States have interests in Afghanistan sufficient to warrant the risks and uncertainties that would be involved in trying to restabilize the country and trying to get involved in solving its humanitarian crises, involved in rebuilding it from the rubble that the war had left it in, involved in isolating the extremists, particularly the Islamist extremists, and trying to stitch together something like a normal Afghan state. And again, that debate, though it wasn't played out in public very often, as a newspaper reporter, I would write it from the region. It would, you know, play on page A22, but it was going on inside the bureaucracy. And it was essentially about, you know, whether we had enough of an interest to warrant this. And ultimately, those who argued that we did lost. And by 1992, 1993, the United States had undertaken a decision to just basically abandon Afghanistan in every respect. And the CIA pulled the plug on its program. The humanitarian aid dried up. Diplomatic interest dried up. We closed our embassy because of security concerns and essentially just left Afghanistan as a vacuum. And it was that vacuum that the Taliban and bin Laden ultimately filled during the 1990s.
Can you tell us about some of the history of bin Laden and U.S. involvement there?
Yeah, so who is Osama bin Laden in the first place? And Osama bin Laden is the son of a Saudi construction billionaire, an illiterate man named Mohammed Awad bin Laden, who walked out of Yemen poor and sort of desperate at the beginning of the Great Depression. He migrated to Jeddah. He started a small brick company. And as Saudi Arabia struck oil and began to grow and modernize, he became close to the royal family and made an enormous fortune as a construction contractor. He, in the style of Bedouin sheikhs, ended up having an enormous number of wives and many children by multiple wives. And Osama bin Laden was, I think he's generally reckoned, though you hear different versions of this, generally reckoned to be the 17th son, who was born in 1957. And what's interesting about Osama in comparison to his brothers is that, you know, most of his half-brothers who grew up with this sudden wealth and all of the kind of contradictions and tensions of coming from a traditional society now rapidly modernizing, most of his half-brothers, however awkwardly, adapted all right. You know, they went abroad for schooling. Maybe they drove their cars too fast or bought airplanes or did other things that, you know, kind of trying to figure out who they were and where they fit. But they didn't become radicalized or fall off the train in some way. They sort of figured out how to live in the world. And Osama was one of a very small number in that family or in other families like it that just became absolutely radicalized by the experience of growing up in this sort of in-between worlds place. And for him, it happened while he was at college as a sophomore in 1979, a year of great excitement and inflammation in the Islamic world. He was going to school in Jeddah. His professors were members of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a, you know, anti-colonial movement going back 50 years, very radical in its outlook, very exclusionary about sort of non-Muslims and very political in its aims and militant. And so he was a sophomore being taught by radicals in a moment of great inflammation and excitement in the Islamic world, and then, boom, the Soviets come into Afghanistan, and so he goes there, initially as a volunteer from a wealthy family. Later, he gets appointed to a committee of leading citizens of Saudi Arabia representing wealthy families to help carry out the government's policies in Afghanistan. And I think one of the disclosures that I feel pretty confident about in this book, based on interviewing that's on the record and other things, that Osama over the 1980s essentially became an instrument of the Saudi government in Afghanistan. He worked quite closely with the intelligence department of Saudi Arabia. He almost certainly wasn't like a paid agent because he was too rich to need the money, but he seems to have worked under contract for the Saudi intelligence department, shipping in supplies to the rebels, building these caves and rock depots and hospitals that we've come to know about since September 11th. And so he wasn't just an individual, a volunteer. He was part of the Saudi government's response to the Afghan war. And he didn't have direct contact with the United States that I was able to determine, but he had indirect support from the United States, which U.S. worked with Saudi intelligence and Saudi intelligence worked with bin Laden. The U.S. worked with Pakistani intelligence and Pakistani intelligence worked with bin Laden. You know, he might show up at some embassy parties in Islamabad and maybe people sort of bumped into him. People certainly knew who he was by 1987, that he was a player, that he was out there, that he had money, that he was building things, and he showed up in U.S. reporting about what was happening. But his operational relationship was with the Saudis first and Pakistanis second.
Talk about then in 93, was that when?
By then we were pretty much gone, yeah.
So what happened in that vacuum? The Taliban were created?
Yes. After the Soviets left, bin Laden left too. He went back to Saudi Arabia 89-90. He went back to his family's construction firm. The Saudi government was a little bit worried about where his head was at. They tried to get him involved in business and to kind of take his mind off of radical war. But he became increasingly strident and an implacable opponent of the Saudi regime. And for Osama himself, a turning point came during the 1990 Gulf War when Saddam invaded Kuwait. And after that invasion, Osama went to the Saudi defense minister and presented him a 60-page memo that said, "I will solve the problem of Saddam's invasion. I will leave the Mujahideen into Kuwait and liberate Kuwait for you. I have just defeated the Soviet Union, by the way, so I'm in good position to do this." And the Saudi defense minister essentially, you know, sort of patted him on the back and said, you know, "No, I don't think that's going to work," and they placed him under house arrest. And then they invited the United States in, 600,000 troops. And that was, I think, one of the first important phases where Osama began to develop his anti-American ideas, his idea that in order to defeat Saudi Arabia's corrupt royal family, you had to strike at the United States. Because he'd been humiliated in his mind by, you know, the way they'd turned down his proposal and used the Americans to solve the problem of the Saddam invasion. And he also saw that the royal family was utterly dependent on the United States to solve its problems and to deal with its security. So that's where he was as this vacuum in Afghanistan opened up. The Saudis sort of threw him out of Saudi Arabia. He went initially to Sudan. Meanwhile, back in Afghanistan, the civil war after the Soviet departure worsened and worsened. And the United States got out, Europe got out, the UN essentially stopped paying attention. And in that vacuum, the Taliban arose initially as a small militia in the south, just one faction among many in a really complicated war. But once they took control of the southern city of Kandahar in the fall of 1994, the Pakistan Army, which was really frustrated that they hadn't been able to find a single Afghan movement that they could promote to take control of Afghanistan, calm the place down, and make it friendly to Pakistan, which was essentially their objective, because they had this huge unruly neighbor to their west, which they feared could destabilize Pakistan and also become a spot for India to make trouble against Pakistan. And what they were always trying to accomplish was to put a government in Kabul that was friendly to Islamabad, unfriendly to India, and that could calm Afghanistan down. So they spotted the Taliban essentially as a small potential client in the fall of 94, and they started secretly pumping support to them and promoting them as the new solution for Afghanistan, a military solution. So between 1994 and September of 1996, with a lot of secret support from the Pakistan Army that the Pakistan government didn't acknowledge at the time, the Taliban took power in most of Afghanistan. They finally took Kabul, the capital, in September of 1996. And so they established themselves as the new order. There were still the Northern Alliance kind of backed up in the north of the country, led by Ahmad Shah Massoud, and trying still to fight the Taliban. But the Taliban had taken control of a lot of territory. So then the last chapter of this phase is bin Laden. We left him sent off into exile into Sudan after getting crosswise with the Saudi royal family. In Sudan, he sets up a little multinational army of like-minded radicals. He expands the idea of al-Qaeda into a global movement that will fight infidel invaders of historical Muslim lands, notably and most biggest priority being the United States. In 1996, the U.S. pressures the government of Sudan to get rid of him because they think that he is financing assassination attempts against leaders like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, and he's just making all kinds of trouble. And Sudan, looking to get back into the good graces of the United States in order to sell oil, throws him out. So he leaves Khartoum in May of 1996, and he goes back to Afghanistan just as the Taliban are taking over. And that's the beginning of that partnership between bin Laden and the Taliban, 1996.
Did the U.S. have knowledge and or support Pakistan's effort to build up the Taliban?
It's a good question. They didn't actively contribute to the guns and money that Pakistan was supplying the Taliban. They watched passively as this developed, and increasingly by their statements and by their policies, the U.S. government made clear that it didn't really have much of a problem with the Taliban taking over, that if the Taliban would provide an end to the civil war and a source of stability, even if they were sort of medieval in their ideas about women and totalitarian in their approach to religion, that might be an acceptable, at least short-term, price to pay for the end of a long and brutal civil war. That was more or less what American officials said in public as this roll-up of Afghanistan was taking place. And then that posture became infected by another American interest, which was a prospective oil and gas pipeline across Afghanistan that was a project sponsored by Unocal, the American oil company. And the pipeline was meant to export oil and gas from Turkmenistan, which is a neighbor of Afghanistan, to its northwest, across Afghanistan to customers in Pakistan and maybe eventually in India. And this pipeline always looked like a pretty difficult thing to build, but the only way that you might be able to get it done would be if you had a stable government in Afghanistan that would provide security as well as permission for the pipeline. And Unocal, I think, as well as its allies in the United States government, began to think, well, the Taliban might be able to pull that off. So I think the endorsements, or at least the passivity that the United States provided to the Taliban during this period, is informed by, influenced by Unocal pushing, saying, look, we need a stable government to get this pipeline done.
Back up a sec. How much truth was there to the statement that bin Laden had made to the Saudis that I was the key person that pushed the Soviets out?
Well, not enough to take a risk on sending him in to defeat Saddam. The Arab volunteers in the anti-Soviet war played a relatively small role, not insignificant, but not decisive. The Soviet occupation of Afghanistan was defeated by Afghans. Virtually every Afghan resisted the Soviet occupation. It was such a popular war, and Afghans suffered unimaginably, 1 million dead, 5 million in exile over the course of 10 or 11 years. The Arabs came in as volunteers. For them, it was like Spain was for the European left in the 1930s. It was a righteous cause, an international cause, not controversial, moral. And so there may be at the height, there might have been 20,000 Arabs who came through and participated. They fought typically in isolated units. They didn't blend very well with the Afghans. They were separated by language, culture. And the Afghans often found the Arabs kind of arrogant and even borderline racist in their attitudes towards them. And so there wasn't a lot of love between ordinary Afghans and these Arab volunteers. There were a few radical Afghan leaders who kind of worked with the Arabs, but at the grassroots, it was not a very comfortable relationship in many places. But the Arabs, by 86, 87, 88, there were certainly battles where the Arabs fought and lost men. They perhaps had a few hundred losses over the course of the whole war, which in comparison to Afghan losses is really tiny. But it's not to say they never fought.
So Pakistan has been supporting the Taliban. Taliban are growing. And what happens next? The U.S. seems supportive of this. When did they start having second thoughts?
Well, they never really resolved their attitude toward the Taliban one way or another. And by 1997, 98, new concerns about the Taliban and bin Laden are rising in Washington. One channel of concerns comes from the feminist network, and really it was only the feminists who understood that the Taliban were a kind of totalitarian movement, and they were sort of unyielding in their public campaigning, even when it made UNICAL and UNICAL's allies and the government uncomfortable. So if you look back at the record of American sort of opposition to the Taliban, really the most credible and the most sustained opposition came from American feminists. And that influenced Madeleine Albright when she became Secretary of State. So she started saying and pushing a little bit more than Warren Christopher had done. But it was around the margins. The other concern that began to rise and that began to influence what the United States was actually doing in Afghanistan, though often in secret, was bin Laden himself. When bin Laden arrived in Afghanistan from Sudan in 1996, he blamed the United States for forcing him out of Khartoum. And while you and I might not think of Khartoum as a garden spot, for him it was a fairly comfortable headquarters. He had businesses there. He had offices with air conditioners and nice houses. His family was with him. He had farms. He had horses. He had training camps. He was a big man in a relatively small pond, and he was doing lots of different things that interested him. In Afghanistan, they start all over again. The country was a failed state, didn't even have electricity, never mind the kinds of offices and compounds that he'd enjoyed before. And he didn't even really have very good contacts with the Taliban when he first arrived. Now, he ingratiated himself with them slowly. But the point is, when he arrived, he was quite angry at the United States. And in that first summer that he got there, he went up into a camp in eastern Afghanistan. He wrote a very long declaration of war against the United States, his first official published declaration of war. And this got the Americans' attention. They weren't quite sure what to make of it. He hadn't been proven to have done anything against American targets at that point. But it did generate a secret program, to try to target bin Laden with a sort of counterterrorist sense, either to arrest him or to disrupt him or to kill him in the course of an arrest attempt or something like that. And that program developed quite slowly and was very cautious in a lot of ways, certainly through August of 1998, when bin Laden attacked the two U.S. embassies in Africa. And then after that, it got a little more intense, and they really did, at that point, start to talk about how could we capture or kill this guy.
How did he become the de facto leader of the Taliban, or is that even true?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. He certainly became a de facto leader of Afghanistan, and it happened gradually between early 1997 and really 2000-2001. You know, I interviewed people who were living in Kandahar, the Taliban capital, in 1997, some who were there trying to get this pipeline organized, Americans who, like one guy had a house across the street from bin Laden's house. And, you know, they describe a scene where, you know, bin Laden would come into town in his SUVs and his security escort, 100 guys with guns surrounding him. He's a big, shake, tall guy, white flowing robes. You know, he passes through the bazaars. Everyone's talking, Osama, Osama. It's Friday prayers, open sermons. He'll go to the prayers and show up with his security consort, and he'll either deliver a sermon that praises Mullah Omar, or Mullah Omar will call him out of the audience and say, there is our great friend Osama. And so there became a kind of a public alliance between the Taliban leadership and Mullah Omar that was very visible in Kandahar. And bin Laden solidified that alliance by doing what he had always done in such circumstances, which was to throw money at it. And he started to build things for Mullah Omar in Kandahar, to make Kandahar the glorious capital of the Taliban movement, celebrating the great emir Mullah Omar. And if you go to Kandahar today, as I did after the 9/11 and after the fall of the Taliban to research this book, it's amazing, these unfinished construction projects in downtown Kandahar that bin Laden had started to put together. Some he finished and some were still in progress. First of all, in summer of 99, Mullah Omar's house gets truck bombed in downtown Kandahar, probably by the Iranians or the Northern Alliance, nobody's quite sure. He survives, but bin Laden then builds him this huge mansion complex on the outskirts of town, like 10 acres, walls. It's amazing. You stand up on a hill, look at it, it's sort of purple, it's got mirrors, and it's an incredible thing. You know, it must have cost a million or more to build it, even in Afghan terms. And then he built him an Eid mosque downtown just for Eid celebrations, and it looks like a huge sort of egg, purple. It's kind of garish. It has that sort of Gulf style, a lot of mirrors and stone and colors. Not exactly Taliban, but it was anyways a bin Laden project. And then the one that's the sort of most striking in downtown Kandahar was his unfinished downtown mosque and shopping bazaar that he was building. It's like, it's almost like you go into an American city and you have those signs coming in, you know, 2010, courtesy of the Department of Commercial Development. And it's sort of like these signs that say, you know, courtesy of Osama bin Laden, Kandahar's new mosque and shopping bazaar. And all that's left, you only got like the pillars in. And so there's, you know, those pillars with the steel poles sticking out of them and before the war came. So that was how he ingratiated himself. And beyond the physical infrastructure, you know, there was an ideological alliance and quite a lot of exchange of speeches and ideas and so forth. At the same time, there was an uneasiness between the Taliban and bin Laden, I think increasingly as time went along, because the Americans and eventually the Pakistanis at the behest of the Americans started putting pressure on the Taliban. As bin Laden actually struck and killed Americans, first in Africa, then USS Cole, you know, the Taliban kept being told, you are never going to be recognized as an international government. You're never going to get a dollar of aid. You're never going to be legitimate. And never mind your problems with the human rights crowd and feminists worldwide, but you're never going to get anything from us unless you get rid of bin Laden. And Mullah Omar would occasionally entertain meetings where he'd say, well, maybe if he's really a bad guy, we should turn him over to an Islamic court. But there's no evidence that he ever seriously contemplated challenging bin Laden. You know, some people say even if Mullah Omar had wanted to get rid of bin Laden, he wasn't physically able to do it. After a certain point, al-Qaeda was much stronger than the Taliban militarily. And who would have really successfully been able to arrest Osama bin Laden, or who would have been motivated to do so, given that al-Qaeda would have resisted? And I think that by 1999, even if Mullah Omar had wanted to go arrest Osama, it would have been a pretty tough thing to pull off. But it's interesting, because it gets you right to the question of whether bin Laden, in effect, told Mullah Omar what he had in mind when it came to 9/11. See, bin Laden, because he wasn't defending a country, he wasn't defending physical territory, he wasn't defending a government, he wasn't defending a normal sort of army, he wasn't focused the way even radical governments are focused on the problem of massive retaliation if you hit a strong adversary. So, you know, the Iranians don't come and knock down American buildings, however much they hate us, because they really don't want the United States to go in and knock them down. But bin Laden saw himself as the leader of a virtual community, you know, the Ummah, the global Islamic community of believers, at war with non-believers. And he certainly saw himself working on behalf of physical space, but historical space, historical Muslim lands. He didn't respect any of the modern nation states, and he certainly wasn't worried about Afghanistan. So his interests were a little bit different than the Taliban. The Taliban had to worry about, well, what happens if bin Laden goes out and hits the United States, the United States comes in and knocks us down. And I think that was a source of tension between the Taliban leadership and bin Laden. They kind of wanted bin Laden not to do anything that would cause the end of their government and the end of their, all of what they'd accomplished over the last 6 or 7 years. But they didn't really have the power to prevent him from doing it. And I wonder if, you know, bin Laden appears to have believed that after 9/11, the Americans would come into Afghanistan and then they would get bogged down the way the Soviets were, and there would be a massive resistance to them, and then he would defeat the second superpower. So he may have thought that he was sort of inducing the United States to come into Afghanistan, then the Taliban would beat them. But I'm not sure that the Taliban really wanted that war. I think that the Taliban had much more modest goals in mind. They wanted to defeat the Northern Alliance. They wanted to control the whole country and set up their Islamic State and so forth. And in any event, as we saw in the fall of 2001, they had become so unpopular among ordinary Afghans that they had no hope of winning that contest.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Steve Cole. He is associate editor at The Washington Post and author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. Talks more about the UNICAL pipeline. What did that really mean to both Afghanistan and the region? It would appear that it would, Afghanistan is a country with exception to the opium coming out of there, that that would be probably the biggest financial draw within the country.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a ton of oil and gas in Afghanistan, and really it wasn't Afghan gas or oil that was going to move through this pipe. They were going to get transit fees, you know, it'd be good money, but not transforming like discovering oil in Saudi Arabia or something like that. There's a little bit of gas up north, and but most of that's already piped out and sold. I think the pipeline became a symbol of international priorities in Afghanistan that today is seen by Afghans across a wide range of opinion, I think, as a story of kind of corruption and indifference, and it's just a really ugly symbol of where the rest of the world was vis-a-vis Afghanistan in the 1990s, that they had their priorities misplaced at a time when ordinary Afghans were suffering under the repression of Taliban religious police and sort of totalitarian rule, when this brutal civil war in which the Taliban would often take no prisoners and slaughter whole villages as they tried to isolate the Northern Alliance. The United States, you know, the international community didn't have any interest in that. They didn't have any interest in the drought or the humanitarian crises, couldn't even fund UN mandates for food aid during a drought. But, you want a pipeline. Well, then now you'll send people in to rent houses in Kandahar and sort of negotiate for rites of passage and that sort of thing. And, I was talking about this the other night with somebody that somebody was saying, well, you know, the pipeline still makes economic sense. It sort of does make economic sense in some sense. Turkmenistan's got all this oil and gas. It's stuck over in an area. It's hard to pipe out through Russia. Pakistan and India need the oil and gas desperately. And you know, Afghanistan could make some money from allowing this thing to be built. But the whole story of that pipeline in the 90s, I think, is now so poisoned in Afghan terms that if you had a democratic parliament consider it, even if it was in their best economic interest, I think they'd reject it. It would be like, you know, sort of restoring some old, horrible chapter of their own history that still, I think, makes a lot of Afghans angry.
And when did things really break down on negotiating for the pipeline? From what I had read, it looked like when it got to a point of where the Taliban wanted a percentage of the actual oil coming out of the pipeline that they could do with whatever, that's when the UNICAL side of it kind of went, okay, we're out of here.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. The details are, you know, a little bit complicated, but basically, there was no way that Unocal could get this pipeline financed unless the World Bank came in, because no private bank was going to lend money to build a pipeline across a country as unstable as Afghanistan. There was just nobody who was going to lend that money. But the World Bank lends money for risky projects where those projects seem likely to help the development of a poor country. So, you know, for the World Bank, a pipeline like this is kind of a typical thing for them. They do dams and these kinds of infrastructure projects in poor countries where private capital won't go in. So Unocal's objective was to convince the World Bank and maybe the Asian Development Bank, similar kind of outfit, to guarantee the financing of the pipeline. But the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank wouldn't do that unless there was a government in Afghanistan that was recognized by the international community. So at the beginning of the project, the Taliban didn't even control the capital, Kabul. The Pakistan Army was promoting them. They were sweeping across the south. They were pushing up toward Kabul, but the Northern Alliance still had Kabul. In September of 96, they took Kabul, and Ahmad Shah Massoud had to retreat back to the Panjshir Valley in the north. Once they took Kabul, then Unocal started to get excited about, you know, maybe now we've got enough of the country to get recognition. And the Taliban's allies, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia in particular, wanted the Taliban to be recognized internationally. The pipeline was a factor, but also their regional interests were a factor. They just wanted the Taliban to be legit. And so they recognized the Taliban as the government of Afghanistan. Three countries did: Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. The U.S., even though Unocal sort of wanted it to do so, the U.S. kind of hung back, in part because of pressure from the Feminist Network. I think if there hadn't been that other lobbying arm going on against the Taliban, you might have seen the U.S. decide, well, if we can negotiate for this pipeline, we'll recognize the Taliban. But anyway, they hung back, and they said, well, let's see. Meanwhile, Unocal, in order to convince the World Bank that it wasn't just favoring the Taliban, kept going around to all the different factions of the war, trying to get them to sign pieces of paper saying, I agree the pipeline's a good idea. And to make it even more like sort of around the world in 80 days or some kind of crazy story, there was a second pipeline company competing with Unocal, run out of Saudi Arabia and Argentina, and that seemed to involve Saudi intelligence, because Prince Turki, the head of Saudi intelligence, had helped to put this second pipeline deal together. So they were going around, not just with the Taliban, but also with the Northern Alliance, and saying, you know, we're the better pipeline builder. And at one stage, that second group gave the Northern Alliance $1 million as a deposit, which they put into a bank in New York. And Unocal, because of American law, couldn't, like, go around and give big chunks of cash to people without an actual deal. So they sent a guy in. He went into Kandahar to try to convince the Taliban to sign up with him, and he brought, like, big orange Unocal soccer balls and frisbees, which he handed out in Kandahar. he talks about how he went to the park and all the kids were throwing the frisbees around. He felt really great about Unocal's chances. But in the end, nobody could quite stitch the whole thing together because the Taliban, in the end, weren't really interested in normal economic development. They were interested in vanquishing their enemies, killing all their enemies, making Afghanistan into a 7th-century state. You know, the thing, there's a French scholar named Olivier Roy who understands political Islam in Afghanistan probably better than anybody in the world, and he's been studying and living there since the 80s. And I just remember a phrase that he used once talking about the Taliban. He said, you know, the thing that people didn't understand about the Taliban was that they really meant what they said. It was as really simple as that. And Mullah Omar was incredibly stubborn, and he never yielded on even the most irrational ideas. And even when they, you know, obviously ran against his self-interest, Afghanistan's interest, the narrow interests of the Taliban leadership, didn't matter. I mean, he gave away the whole country for the sake of Osama bin Laden in the end. So, you know, he really did mean what he said.
And do you know anything about Hamid Karzai, if he had ties to Unocal?
I don't think that he ever had direct ties to Unocal, but he was involved with the Taliban, interestingly, in the early days, in 94 and 95. And he was asked by the Taliban to be their ambassador to the UN. And this was around the time that the Unocal project was developing. And he was around the group that became part of the UNICAL Board of Advisors, including the current U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, who was on that Board of Advisors in the 95, 96, 97 period. But the reason that Karzai was involved with the Taliban, he broke with them when the Taliban assassinated his father, and then he became the most adamant opponent of the Taliban in the south of Afghanistan. He took a lot of personal risks against the Taliban between the time of his father's assassination, well, even before his father's assassination, 98, 99, right through to 2001. So, you know, just because he supported the Taliban earlier, I just want to emphasize, you know, he was leading the charge against them later. But at the beginning, the reason that he was drawn to them was that, you know, the Taliban, their ideas about religion were never terribly popular in Afghanistan. They were completely at odds with Afghan national traditions of religion. I mean, Afghanistan is the traditional forms of Islam in Afghanistan, even in the most conservative rural areas, are not like what the Taliban preaches at all. They're more Sufi influenced, meaning that they emphasize the worship of individual saints, and there's a kind of a decorative, celebratory, and mystical streak of traditional Afghan Islam, all things that the Taliban tried to eliminate, wiping out saint shrines and you know, just preaching against a lot of basic ideas that had been around in Afghan cultural and religious life for a long time. But they were popular because they cleaned up the security problem. Everybody was tired of being kidnapped and murdered and stuff. But more importantly, as they got settled and started to make their claims, they spoke to the Pashtuns of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has, you know, sort of essentially is divided in half. In the north are what you might think of as traditional ethnic groups, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Bamiyan Shia, and some other groups. And in the south are the Pashtuns, tribal federations, speak the Pashto language, very proud national history in Afghanistan. And the Taliban became a vehicle for Pashtun nationalist aspirations, even beyond their religious ideas. They basically exploited a feeling among Pashtuns that they had been left out of the post-war arrangements. And so that's what drew Karzai in. He had been in the government with the Northern Alliance. He'd fallen out with the Northern Alliance. He'd gone back into Pakistan. And like a lot of people, he sort of got excited about the idea, well, maybe the Pashtuns have a way to get back here, and the Taliban is it. So he was hanging around them around the time that this UNICAL thing was going on, but more as a sort of a Pashtun. He has royal blood and credibility as a sort of a figure of a very prominent family, been very politically active, but also because he stayed during the 80s. Like a lot of privileged Afghans, as privileged as he, went to Europe or the United States and kind of, but he stayed. So he's a credible figure, but he's had a very complicated history with the Taliban.
All right, I have to ask you about the caves that became so famous when the U.S. was bombing Afghanistan. Can you tell us about if the U.S. had any role in the creation of those caves?
Yeah, I think that there were certainly American dollars in a direct and indirect way flowing toward those construction projects. Those caves were built in the later part of the anti-Soviet war along the Pakistan-Afghan border, mainly by an alliance among Pakistani intelligence, Pakistani army, bin Laden and al-Qaeda and his group. And it was bin Laden's bulldozers and bin Laden's trucks and bin Laden's construction expertise that was at the heart of a lot of those building projects. And a few important Afghan radical Islamist leaders, particularly Jalaluddin Haqqani, who's still at large and who's thought to be like a key person even today, joined the Taliban eventually and probably knows where bin Laden is if anybody does today. Haqqani and Sayaf. And the reason they built these caves was that during the anti-Soviet war, all of the supplies, the guns that the Mujahideen used, no matter whether they were bin Laden people or others in the resistance, you know, they came in generally through Karachi, they got shipped up to the frontier, and then the rebels had to kind of carry them over the border by mule, walk them in one way or another. There was no airdropping going on, and there was really no other way to infiltrate into Afghanistan except from Pakistan over the border. You could go at the north, the south, whatever. And By the late 80s, bin Laden and Haqqani and the Pakistanis decided they needed some infrastructure along the border so that they could store stuff and that they could sit in one place and have some hospitals, field hospitals, so if fighters got wounded, they didn't have to come all the way back out to Pakistan and that sort of thing. And bin Laden had his own ambition. He wanted these complexes, the caves and the depots and everything, so that he could have his own base for his own volunteers and his army and stuff, so that when volunteers came in, they didn't just stay in Pakistan or go off randomly to fight in a particular battle. They'd go to bin Laden's camps. That's where al-Qaeda was really born. Plus, bin Laden's a construction guy. He likes to build things. He loves bulldozers. And so he really pushed for this construction project and for building these caves and the hospitals. And Haqqani supported him. And the Saudi government probably paid for a lot of those caves directly. But U.S. money through Pakistan was also being poured into these sets of projects, roads and caves. Now, a lot of the Americans, not all of them, but I think the decisive American view at the CIA station at the time was, this is really not a very smart thing to do. They didn't really care about bin Laden at that time. And he was just, another volunteer among many. But they thought the whole point of your guerrilla war is you hit and run. As soon as you start building stuff that the Soviets can find, they're going to come and bomb it. And, they're going to come and attack it. You're winning because you're elusive. So why spend all of this money building stuff that is just going to invite the Soviets in to attack? And in fact, after bin Laden built these caves and hospitals, that's what happened. The Soviets sent special forces in to try to destroy these facilities. And that was where bin Laden fought his first great battle at Jaji, defending the caves that he had built. Whether in the long run it would have been viable for them to hold on to these facilities under Soviet pressure, nobody ever really discovered, because the Soviets decided to quit before, the whole idea of building all this stuff was tested in a serious way. But that's where they came from.
It seems like so much of this doesn't make sense in the long run. When you look at that, the support creation of the Taliban by the Pakistanis, where they're basically supporting a group that in the long run is not good for Pakistan, as well as the Saudis, heavily supporting a group that, at least in terms of the Saudi royal family, is eventually going to overthrow them in their home country. And then you look at the U.S. going along with all this and basically supporting the two efforts that will, come full circle.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting, we spent a lot of time talking about the American. I mean, the Americans at least at the beginning had a motivation, which was the Soviet Union, big global contest. But you're right in every respect, I think. It's interesting, let's talk a little bit about Pakistani and Saudi motivations, which are, less familiar to us. The Pakistanis, it wasn't a national decision among every faction of Pakistan politics to think, well, we ought to control Afghanistan with radical Islamists. Most of the political forces, the civilian political forces in Pakistan, opposed the idea of promoting people like the Taliban, or before the Taliban, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was the earlier radical Islamist proxy of Pakistan ambitions in Afghanistan. But the army, and particularly the intelligence service, believed that it was crucial to Pakistan's national interest to control Afghan territory. And the reason they believed it was not just that Afghanistan was a historically unruly neighbor whose Pashtun population spilled across Pakistan's borders and threatened to create problems inside Pakistan, and so therefore it needed to be controlled, but also because for the Pakistan Army, basically if you want to try to figure out Pakistan Army motivations about anything, ask the question, where does India fit? Because for them, it's all about India. This was an army leadership, and Musharraf was a part of this, is a part of it, that fought and lost three wars against India. In 1971, the last war they fought flat out, they lost half their territory when Bangladesh became independent. And they feel dwarfed and intimidated by India, much larger nation, much larger industrial potential, much larger standing army. And for the Pakistan Army during the 1980s, the jihadi movement became the most potent strategic weapon they could invent against India, because it was the one thing that scared India, jihadis. When the Pakistan Army began to infiltrate Afghan war-style jihadi guerrillas into Kashmir, They ended up tying down 600,000 Indian troops in Kashmir without ever having to deploy a single Pakistan enlisted man. And a lot of the army officers, including Musharraf, were personally liberal in their own religious and political outlook, even secular, to the point of, you know, being completely comfortable with American kind of culture and idiom and so forth. Jihad was something they did at the office to punish India. They'd go to the office and they'd say, let's promote some really scary Frankenstein-type jihadis. We use them to both set India on its heels and contain India, and also to deprive India of Afghanistan as a way to come back around the back door and try to get at us. So for them, they had this idea that it was statecraft. It was wily statecraft. And the British used to do this sort of thing. So, you know, they said, well, we're just learning the British lessons. But what you said earlier about how, you know, in the long run, this was going to bite them. By the late 90s, even after they had succeeded in putting the Taliban into Kabul, and finally, after all of this blood and effort, they had sort of halfway gotten to what they'd always set out to do, there was an immediate recognition inside the Pakistani elite, in the diplomatic service, in the press, in the, you know, in the big business families, in ordinary middle, in universities, in civil society, and there is a civil society in Pakistan, however beleaguered. Immediately, this is a really bad idea. This is going to blow back into Pakistan. They started arguing against it. By the time you got the reason Musharraf changed course after 9/11 wasn't just one guy going into, you know, the bathroom, staring in the mirror and say, okay, I'm going to go this way. It was that basically he had been told, even by a lot of generals around him, this is a losing strategy. You know, whatever clever idea somebody thought they had is going to bring us all down. We've got to reverse course. And so that argument had been developing inside Pakistan even before 9/11, and 9/11 kind of crystallized it for them. Now, the Saudis are sort of a tougher nut to crack. You know, they never have had this open debate about, you know, for them, this idea of radical, exclusionary, proselytizing Islam is fundamental to the birth and identity of the nation. And while the royal family is quite diverse in its, you know, sort of character and includes a lot of not very pious princes, nonetheless, the whole premise of Saudi Arabia rests on the idea that this is a state devoted to political Islam with more rigor and more purity and more commitment than any other Islamic state. And by positioning the state that way, they justify their control of the two holiest places in Islam, pilgrimage sites where millions of ordinary Muslims travel on a yearly Hajj. But domestically, faced with a clerical establishment that questioned the royal family's legitimacy and piety from time to time, and faced with dissidents like Osama bin Laden, and he wasn't alone, who said, you guys claim to be religious, but you're not really, and you really ought to yield to a more righteous approach. Faced with those kinds of pressures, the Saudi government tended to say, why don't you go change the world? we're going to support your proselytizing and humanitarian and other efforts to lift up the condition of Muslims worldwide. That's our mission. That's our shared mission. And the royal family would essentially provide enormous resources to all sectors of the Islamist establishment and opposition at home, encouraging them to take their ideas abroad and fix places like Afghanistan. And it was a way to blow steam off, basically, to redirect. There were some people who worried about it coming back on them, but they really didn't know how else to manage it. And ultimately, there's some people who say, well, it suited the royal family quite well to have bin Laden and his allies focus on the United States, because it meant they weren't focusing on them. But that trick only lasted so long, and now the royal family, you know, recognizes on the whole that they're in the crosshairs themselves.
Well, unfortunately, we are running low on time. What final thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I guess just only that one thing that strikes me as you go around and talk about this history with people like you, you have good questions and right questions and stuff. So much about what happened in those 20 years is still present. It's not as if a lot of these questions or problems have really sort of changed in some profound way. I mean, just take Pakistan. This question of what kind of an ally Pakistan is, where the interests of the Pakistan army really lie, is very much alive now. And yes, the Pakistan army has changed in very important ways compared to the late 90s. I mean, they really are giving Afghanistan a break for a change. You know, they're kind of holding back and letting Afghanistan sort of develop on a model that's different from their pursuit of an Islamist government. But at the same time, you know, they're holding this idea of the jihadi force in reserve, not so much because they are worried today about Afghanistan, but because they're still worried about India. And I don't think the Pakistan army has made a final and strategic decision to give up jihad as an instrument of national and regional policy. I think they basically decided, well, temporarily it pays better to stand these guys down, you know, put them under house arrest or give them some businesses to run for a little while, because the Americans will load us up with guns and money if we cooperate with them. And when the jihadis started to try to kill Musharraf, that also got his attention and made it sort of personal for him. But even Musharraf, on the receiving end of these attacks, I think sees himself as somebody engaged in statecraft against India who can't afford to give up the jihadi threat yet, and so it ain't over.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
No, thanks. I enjoyed it.
We've just been talking with Steve Cole. He is the associate editor at The Washington Post and author of the book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001.